All right. Paul, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
It's early in the morning. I want to read from a social media post that I saw last week that someone fronted to me. This is from you. Today, I helped 11 folks at a safe rest village apply to replace their lost or stolen birth certificates. When this city sweeps unhoused folks, these essential documents often get lost. The new safe rest villages have time limits of 90 days before people are exited. That's not enough time to be housing ready, especially if you've lost your ID. I wrote checks to 4 different states in this batch, and 2 of them required a notary to authenticate the application, which I am. This is Paul's post. Wait times are anywhere from 4 weeks to 3 months. I spent roughly $270 on these applications because the policymakers don't think about this and no one supplies the funds, staffing, notaries to complete these processes. Please remember these obstacles the next time a neighbor complains about homelessness. If you want to help, Venmo me at paul-j.susie. Paul, thanks again for being here. Talk about your work. It might sound obvious, but what do you do and why?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to be here. As I was saying before the broadcast, I'm a Portland native, and KBOO is very near and dear to my heart. So it's really lovely to be here. I'm just a private citizen. All my adult life, I've worked in social services. Before the pandemic, I led some homeless shelters for transition projects here in Portland. And during that time, I noticed some systemic obstacles for folks as they were trying to transition out of homelessness and into housing. And one of the biggest insurmountable obstacles that I kept seeing over and over again was the problem of what to do when you've lost your ID. And if you're living out on the streets and you've lost your ID to theft or to fire, or you left everything when you fled your abuser, or your encampment was swept by the police, you then not only do you not have your ID, you also don't have the resources to replace your ID. You need proof of ID, as well as the fees, as well as a mailing address, as well as all kinds of things, depending on what you're missing. And this was especially acute for folks who maybe weren't born in Oregon, but were born in California or Washington or Ohio or Florida, any state in the union, and the territories as well. There are some folks from the American Overseas Territories that are on our streets. And in order to replace those birth certificates, sometimes those jurisdictions require a notary. A special rubber stamp that's issued by the county that you live in. And, you know, usually the only notaries around here are folks who are mortgage brokers or who are paralegals or who are otherwise likely to charge you significant amounts of money for the privilege of that rubber stamp. So that's just one of the many myriad obstacles for folks experiencing homelessness and houselessness right now that more privileged decision makers, you know, you just don't think about that on a regular basis, because why would you? But for maybe any of us, you know, when's the last time you lost your wallet or your purse and you had to go through the hassle of replacing all of those things? Now imagine that obstacle multiplied by the experience of living outside and being harassed by more privileged members of our fair city.
You know, my mom had her wallet stolen earlier this year, and she's 93 years old. She lives in California, and she's had to drive hours away to replace some of these documents. And if she didn't have someone's help,
right,
I don't know what she would do. And that includes the ID that it's required for her to access her health insurance. So I want to ask you, too, how did you come to this idea? Where did the idea come from?
Yeah. Well, like as I said, I was a shelter manager. So for transition projects for about 5 years. In that 5-year span, I opened and or closed six different homeless shelters in that time period. And that was because the funding was, you know, the funding was contingent, and different neighbors didn't want shelters in their neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. And in that time of experiencing running homeless shelters, this obstacle, a lost ID, kept coming up. And, you know, each shelter program had about 100 participants per program, you know, 100 beds. And I would lead staff teams of anywhere from 15 to 25. And we would have an annual budget line item for ID assistance for our guests, for our clients. And we would always exhaust that ID budget by, you know, the second month of the fiscal year. So the need was always far eclipsing the resources available. After pandemic began, I was very, very pleased to notice that the DMV collaborated with local nonprofits and said, okay, we're going to issue waiver letters. So if you're accessing social resources at a DV shelter, say, or at a homeless shelter, or if you're accessing substance abuse resources, that nonprofit is able to issue you a waiver letter so you don't have to pay the fee at the DMV. But you still need to bring proof of ID. So it's a very Kafkaesque solution, right? Like, we won't ask you for the $30 or the $40 that we would normally ask you for, but you still need to bring a social security card. You need to bring a birth certificate. You need to bring a government issued something. And so, you know, in some ways it's like one step forward, one step back. So the project that I have launched was inspired by the mutual aid projects that have come up all around the city now. I'm not asking for any requirements. I'm not asking for any qualifications. If you reach out and you need help replacing any of your ID documents, whether it's an ID card, a driver's license, a birth certificate, anything, I can help. And I will write a check. And I will use my notary stamp if I have to. And I will help you fill out the forms. And then together we can mail them at the post office. Unfortunately, you know, you're still waiting 3 to 6 weeks or more for a birth certificate. Or I can give you a check to take physically to the DMV together with a memo connecting, because my name is on the check, connecting the check to you so that the DMV will accept that check. It's a convoluted process, but it's I think of it as cosplaying as a bureaucrat, because I'm trying to think of all of the systemic obstacles that a person encounters when they're just trying to get their stuff together.
A bureaucrat for the people. I know that I already asked you this, and we all think that we know what it is to be swept when you don't have anything and you're living on the sidewalk, but it's more than just losing your wallet. It's more than just having your backpack stolen. Like, it's a huge emotional burden. And can you just talk a little bit more about the people that you serve? Like, what are they facing? And can you share some of the words? What are people telling you when they come and ask for your services?
Yeah, I should hasten to say that, like, I don't keep tabs, right? Like, this is a one and done, you know, I'm not trying to save anybody. This isn't in me being a superhero. I'm just trying to see a big systemic obstacle that keeps coming up. What I've heard from folks, So I do still have lots of friends and peers and former colleagues who work in various shelter programs, and so that's my primary source of referrals. Is, you know, someone's at one of the shelters that I used to work at, and a former colleague reaches out to me and says, hey, we've got this person who, you know, for whatever reason, they don't qualify for whatever resources we may have in our program for them. And so then I come out and I sit down with them and I help them out. And what I've heard in those interactions are things like, this is the first time that, you know, anybody has treated me like a human being, that, you know, which is, again, not a criticism of any of the organizations, but that's just, we've made, we as a culture have made it so systematically difficult. We assume the worst of everybody. We assume everybody is trying to get away with something. And then when we ourselves get in the situation of our own worst case scenarios, then we find ourselves in a straitjacket of our own making, right? So the folks are telling me things like, you know, this is the first time I've had to think about when my mom's birthday was, because I have to fill that out on the form. I have to think about their name before their marriage. I have to think about this hometown that I fled when I was fleeing an abusive situation. All of these horrible things. And I'm now trying to reclaim my identity for myself, because I'm trying to move on from all of these things. So in some ways, it's a powerful, empowering experience, literally humanizing yourself in the eyes of the state. But in other ways, it's a painful experience, because for so long, there have been all of these reasons to ignore or to discard your own identity, right? So it's very complicated. It's complicated for different folks. There are some folks, indigenous and Native American folks, that I've tried to work with, where you know, the tribal chairs won't even reply to the email that I send, right? Even though they have all of these documentations, they're just trying to get their tribal ID card again. And then there are some folks, you know, randomly, there are some states that you know, are in the news recently and are maybe less accepting of difference and pluralism in our society. But I gotta say, it's really, really satisfying for me to put my notary stamp on a form to the state of Florida or the state of Ohio, and then they do it. then they issue the birth certificate and no questions asked. Yeah.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Paul Soucy of PDX ID Assistance. He helps people who've been swept by the city and lost their crucial documents. I have to shift gears a little bit and also say, as you heard earlier, this is KBOO Community Radio's incredible winter membership drive. This is a do-it-yourself revolution. If this kind of information, this kind of radio is important to you, please consider investing in these airwaves. Now we're having a generous group of donors who will match your gift one-to-one up to $20,000. Double your contribution today. Every dollar you make gets matched one-to-one. And thanks to a group of KBOO donors just like you. You can make a contribution to support programming like this at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number. 44321. And now back to Paul Soucy. Paul, is there someone who inspired you to do this?
Oh, wow. What a good question. No one specifically inspired me to do this with this project, but I do think a lot about, as I mentioned before we went on air, I was born and raised in this city, and I think a lot about, I was an altar boy at St. Mary's Cathedral when I was little, and in downtown Portland. And there was a very dear pastor there by the name of Father Joseph Jacobberger. Father Joe, if you're listening. He was such a wonderful role model for me when I was, you know, when I was little and I didn't have the best family life, and, you know, my parents split up and all of these things. And Father Joe had this, set this example of quiet, moderate, humble leadership in the community. He wasn't flashy. He wasn't opinionated. He was just very caring. He was very soft-spoken, almost to a fault. Like, people couldn't hear him in his homilies. but he was so kind and so dear. And I think about him a lot as I walk the streets of Portland today. You know, I see his ripples everywhere.
That's amazing. You talked a little bit about your work as a manager and working at shelters, but I wanted to dig into that a little bit more, like, and ask a little bit more about what is your background and how did you decide to get involved with community work?
Yeah, totally. Well, I briefly experienced homelessness when I was in high school. I went to Lincoln High School, class of 99. As I went through, you know, I was a very angry young man. I didn't go to college. I was terrified of debt, even back then, before it was before it had reached the level that it's at now. But I knew then that it was important for me, for my own well-being, that I live in a way that engages with the world, not running away from the world. And I knew that theater was saving my life. Theater was giving me a channel to be a decent human being, to learn how to be a decent human being through poetry, of all things. And then I also knew that theater isn't going to pay the bills. So I have always gravitated towards day jobs that don't pay that much more than theater. I've always been in social services my whole life, frontline social services positions, Hooper Detox, Janus Youth Programs, New Avenues for Youth. It's kind of the greatest hits of Portland. Transition Projects, all of these amazing organizations that are, you know, legacy institutions that have their own systemic challenges, but they've been doing brave work for generations in this city.
Yeah, they have.
And so it makes me really angry, actually, when leadership today at City Hall are like, you know, nobody's doing anything about it. And no, the Transition Projects has been here for 56 years. Like, we've been doing your dirty work for 56 years. So, sorry, I don't mean to.
No, not at all.
So that's essentially where all of this is coming from, is that, you know, I have this huge network of. And yes, I've also burned out from many of those positions, right? Hooper Detox especially was a really, really tough position to work in for an extended period of time. So, you know, it's not all daisies, but it's it is a track record that I'm proud of.
Yeah, outside in too. There's certain nonprofit organizations that have been here for generations, actually. And that's why when we see how that the sort of churn of new residents, new people moving here. And I don't mean to be negative either, but clutching their pearls and saying, oh my God, are you kidding me? Who is that in the sidewalk?
Yeah.
I remember a time when people camped in tents in a ring around City Hall. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
None of this is new.
Right.
And having said that, none of this is new. This is my big opening to geek out about ancient geek literature and ask you and bring it back to the theater production that you're doing about the Iliad. I mean, we're talking about the Trojan War. Like, I mean, I love stuff like this because, as I was saying in the lobby earlier, we act like some of this stuff is new, but I don't think any of this stuff is new. Talk about this production that you're mounting. You know, are you going to have you're going to stage it this weekend?
Yeah.
Can anybody come? And where are you going to take it after that? What's the bigger goal?
Yes. So this is a project called An Iliad. It's a play that's written by Dennis O'Hare and Lisa Peterson, based on Robert Fagel's translation of the Iliad. So it's a modern language adaptation. About 5 years ago, my good friend Patrick Walsh, a director in town, brought me into this project. It's a one-man show, but I should say our mutual friend Anna Fritz, a cellist and a composer, very, very renowned and very talented cellist in this city. She created a score for this project, an original score that is designed for her to play live every time we perform. So she's on stage with me. And we started this project in 2018 to tour to every prison in Oregon and to share the work inside prison walls as well as outside prison walls. My friend, the director Patrick, had been volunteering in prisons for a couple of years and directing a lot of plays. And he wanted to bring something excellent to the guys that had donated so much of their time and energy to the plays in prisons. And I had seen one of the productions. I'd seen a production of Winter's Tale at Two Rivers Correctional Institution, and I was blown away. I was trained as a Shakespearean actor, and which is really silly because I'm a 42-year-old son of Filipino immigrants. Like, there's no earthly reason why I should be trained in Shakespearean theater. But Shakespeare is really important to me. And that production of Winter's Tale at Two Rivers was the finest production I'd ever seen of Winter's Tale. It was extraordinary. These guys poured their whole selves into it. They were so brave, fearless, so raw, and they were wholeheartedly embracing the magicality of that poetry. And so that's what inspired me to, like, okay, I want to give them, I want to be in fellowship with them. I want to be in community with them. And so we toured in Iliad in 2018 and 2019 to a bunch of prisons. And then it was important for us to share the same resources inside as well as outside of prisons, that we're all humans, regardless of whether we're victims or perpetrators, regardless of whether justice has been served, regardless of whether, you know, every 90% of the folks incarcerated are coming back to the communities at one moment or another. So we have to consider what that homecoming is.
Wow. You're turning on lights all over my head.
Yeah.
All over my head. Because of Winter's Tale.
Yeah.
The story of dysfunctional family.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
And the Trojan War, the Iliad, you know, which, if I'm not mistaken, leads into the Odyssey, another
right.
story of coming home.
That's right.
Talk a little bit more about what are some of the themes of the Iliad and what makes it so, I'm just going to say the word, modern. It's ancient, but it's modern. And Homer himself, theoretically, the guy who first told this story, he was an oral historian. Like, he told stories. He didn't put it on Facebook and he didn't put it in the newspaper. So, I'm sorry, what are the themes and why is it important?
Yeah. The Iliad, my thesis is that the Iliad is Homer trying to bear something that is unbearable. My sense of it is that whoever Homer was, if he was one person or many, that he experienced some things and maybe did some things that there was no other way for him to live with himself after those things except by making the Iliad. When I was working all of these social services jobs, one of the most common things I had to do in every position was write an incident report.
Oh my God.
Whenever something happens, who, what, where, when, and maybe why. But don't editorialize, don't embroider, don't try to put a spin on it. Document it so that you can cover your butt and you can cover everybody else's butt. Document what happened. And so, you know, in some of these places, I would have to write these terrible things that were happening by and to terrible people or completely innocent people or everything in between. We're all humans. We're all very complicated. And that connected me to the Iliad. That was the thing that made me understand, oh, that's why this is so messy. That's why it's filled with all these contradictions. That's why one of the books is just a list of ships. Like, it's just Homer getting it out of himself, because if he kept it bottled up, it would have gone towards self-harm. And then to me, the key discovery of the Iliad, I'm spoiling the ending. The key discovery is that Achilles is addicted to rage. He has every reason to be addicted to rage. His lover has been brutally killed. He's never going to go home again. He's never going to see his father again. He has all this pressure to win the war. He's also a terrible, terrible human being. And Priam was the father of the guy that Achilles just killed. Priam has lost all of his sons. He knows his city is going to fall. He knows that his whole family is going to be slaughtered and kidnapped and raped. He has no reason to forgive Achilles. But the two come to a moment of grace and clarity at the end of the book that we call the Iliad, where they let go of their rage. They let go of all of these reasons to hate each other. And they agree to let, you know, Priam is begging for his son's body and for a truce in the war, for a ceasefire now. And Achilles is Achilles is so heartbroken at losing everybody that he's ever loved and knowing that he's going to lose everybody that he's ever loved, but he chooses to let go of his rage. And not even Homer knows how he did it. There's no magic formula, right? I can't tell you how to let go of your rage, but Achilles, the greatest warrior that ever lived, somehow he felt this rage welling up inside of him and he made it disappear. And if Achilles can do that, then, you know, then I believe that there's hope for all of us. I believe there's hope for us in our addiction to mass violence and mass shootings and all of the terrible things that we're afflicted with. If Achilles could do it, so could we.
I feel as if one of the other big aspects of ancient Greek and maybe also Roman literature was the idea of catharsis.
That's right.
You're faced with, you know, you kind of jump to the end, but between the beginning and the end, so much heartbreak, so much violence,
yeah.
And violence to innocent people too. It reminds me of Titus Andronicus.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I am geeking out to the max right now. But it's like you are on this journey with people. It's,
yeah.
it's on a different level than watching a movie on Netflix. It really is.
That's right.
Actually,
That's
to
right.
be there in the room
That's
and to
right.
share the breath.
That's absolutely right. It there are some great movies out there. I don't want to knock them, but it's nothing compared to the live experience. Because if I'm going into a prison with an Iliad, with Anna, and I'm sitting in a room with 100 guys in a prison cafeteria, and Anna starts playing her cello, and then this ancient literature comes through all of these filters, myself, these adults in custody, this cellist, these corrections officers, many of whom have never seen plays before either, right? All of these human beings are bringing your day with you. You're bringing your experiences, your personal history, the thing that you can't get over, the person you can't forgive, or the person who will never forgive you. You're bringing all of those things in your heart to the play. And if you let go of all of the things that you know hem us in our day-to-day lives, that's the real catharsis, to be in space with each other in this moment, sharing these stories. And Anna and I get changed by these guys as much as hopefully they might be changed by our work. We take their emotional, for lack of a better word, their vibes with us. So essentially, this has been a 5-year-long prison break where we're still carrying those guys with us. So that's what we're trying to do this weekend. We're working at the Past Lives Makerspace, which is a gallery space in inner southeast Portland that's founded by and for adults returning from incarceration, where they have a gallery space to show their art and to make their work. They have a blacksmith shop. They have a ceramic kiln. It's a really amazing space. And we were invited to perform there, and we've been inviting folks to come to this performance. We purchased the rights for the play and everything. We're inviting donors to come to this performance so that we can raise money, so that we can get back into these prisons again to continue this tour. Earlier this year, a middle school, West Sylvan Middle School, Dr. Holly Graham invited us to perform an Iliad, because like you, she's also a geek for ancient Greek literature. And these sixth graders sought us out. We weren't touring. Pandemic happened. We had left this project behind. But these sixth graders, which if you're, you know, paying attention to anything, our schools right now are going through all kinds of things. And these sixth graders saw that we had done an Iliad before, and they asked us to come back because of all of the things that they were going through in their school. There's some racial tension, and there's some immigrant communities from folks who are at war with them and one another right now. There are Ukrainian refugees and Russian refugees and Iranian refugees at West Sylvan. And so that's why they invited us. And that's what kickstarted this project, this round of the project again.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Paul Soucy of PDX ID Assistance, and as we just discussed, and Iliad. He helps people who've been swept by the city and lost their crucial documents. We're coming back to that in a second, but I have to give you another opportunity to consider investing in these airwaves because, as I said before, it's a do-it-yourself revolution, right? This show is not sponsored by Nike, okay? So donate to KBOO right now during the end of the year campaign. Your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000. Thanks to the generous support of a group of KBOO donors, our big goal for this drive is $50,000. You can make a contribution to support programming like this at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Now back to Paul Soucy. Just to close that hoop for a second, mm-hmm. as you're working with unhoused people and you have worked with all of these, as we already said, heritage nonprofits in our town that work with some of the most vulnerable people, how many of those people actually are experiencing reentry from the prison system? I mean, how many of the people you see out here are people that just got out of jail? They cannot they cannot get an apartment because there's the check the box thing. They can't get a job. Can you just link these issues to us for us for a minute?
Yeah. Well, the new head of Oregon's Department of Corrections, Mike Reese, is our former sheriff here in Multnomah County. Stand-up guy, really decent human. He was on the board of Transition Projects when I worked for Transition Projects. He used to say in our board meetings, when he was concurrently the sheriff of Multnomah County as he was serving on our board, which I thought was a pretty powerful thing. He used to say in the board meetings that the Multnomah County Jail is actually the biggest provider of homeless services in our area, and it's unseen as that, right? The shelter systems before the pandemic. My information is a little dated because I left Transition Projects before the pandemic, but the shelter systems then, when I left, I would say anecdotally that between 50% and 80% of folks coming into our shelters had some legacy of incarceration. Now, there's a lot of churn too, right? And it's notoriously difficult to get hard data about all of this because, you know, the way that we collect the data is the point in time count.
It's absurd.
It is really absurd. It's dehumanizing. It's incredibly inefficient. It's terribly backwards. But it's the only source of data we have. And I remember at the time that the point in time counts would routinely show 4,000, 6,000 folks sleeping on the streets when internally we would unofficially always be saying, oh, that number is probably two to three times an undercount, right? And I think that that's still consistently the case. I like to say to folks when they ask about Portland with all of those horror stories is that, you know, before the pandemic, the social services continuum of Portland was like a six-lane freeway. This is a terrible analogy because it's freeways, but it was like a six-lane freeway. And it would take you about 2 years on average between when you're on the curb and thinking about getting into housing to getting into housing. About 2 years to navigate that social services continuum that was a six-lane highway. So you had a two-year commute. Pandemic happens. All of those lanes shut down. Traffic comes to a standstill. Everything backs up. And it should have been 12 lanes, by the way. It should have been two to three times the infrastructure that was available to us. Now, stuff has come back online, but a lot of programs have gone away for good, or a lot of programs are only at 50% capacity. So now, it's like we're at three lanes are moving. And then people are saying, well, where did all these people come from? Well, it's because you've been stuck in traffic for years. So if you think about all of the things that happen in those 2 years, getting a job, getting clean and sober, getting health care for the first time, getting therapy, getting any of the things, addressing expungement issues on your criminal record, all of the things that need to happen between when you choose, when you're at the curb and you're choosing to get into housing, to actually getting in the door, getting your ID. The 2 years have been taken away from you, and we've added more years because we don't we never had enough lanes to begin with. We never had enough housing to begin with. I forget where I was going.
No, we were just talking about why is this such a big issue now? And right. And my little axe to grind is I personally believe that where we see large communities of people that cannot afford to live indoors, part of that has to do with real estate speculation. That's right. Not what we're talking about today.
Right, right.
But and just on that note, because I'm being a nerd right now, I'm a mega Shakespeare nerd.
Yeah.
I've loved Shakespeare since I was a child. But I want to encourage anyone who thinks about the highfalutin Shakespeare plays to go research his life and look up how he died, and I'm leaving it there.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
That's all I'm saying. And when you said, you know, who is Homer? You know, is that a group of people? There's a lot of conversation about that with Shakespeare as well. And that also goes back to go look at what happened the night he died. And it's kind of more like, how does that guy do the Star Wars movies? George Lucas gets all the credit, I guess, but probably a dozen people helped write that. And the other thing I wanted to say was Mike Reese was also the Portland police chief. He has sat in every one of these chairs, Portland police chief, Multnomah County sheriff, and now the corrections guy.
Yeah.
So. Breathing, coming back. Now, I wanted to just go back to the nuts and bolts of where we started. What is the process for helping people rebuild their ID documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's say you're coming to me and you don't have your ID. You lost your ID. And my first question is, do you have anything, any government issued anything? Social Security card, voter registration card is a good one, passport, anything. Do you have a document from law enforcement, a parole and probation document, or a hospital document with your name and your birth date? Anything can potentially be something. It's never enough, but it can be. Those are all essential pieces. Different jurisdictions, different places will ask for different numbers of things based off of whatever they wanted. You know, Louisiana is very different from Kentucky, is very different from Ohio, because, you know, 50 states in this union. So I start with, what do you have? Some of shelter IDs can play a role in this too. If you have a transition projects card, or if you have a Portland Rescue Mission card, those aren't enough on their own, but they do help to establish you in the eyes of the DMV and the Department of Vital Statistics. Then I ask, what city and state were you born? Ideally, I've asked this ahead of time so I can have the form printed out. So then I sit with you, and I help you fill out the form. And then, you know, with photocopies of whatever IDs you have, and again, different places require different numbers of these things, I can then include those photocopies with that application form, and then I write the check to the Department of State of Ohio or of Michigan or whatever, of Washington, right? Oregon Health Authority, Vital Statistics, Department of Health in Washington, that kind of thing. And I write the check to that government entity. And I also write out a memo, a pre-printed memo form saying, this check number 1234, written out in the amount of X dollars, is to help John Smith replace his birth certificate. If you have any questions, reach out to me, and then there's my cell phone and my email. So all of those steps are designed to encourage the bureaucrat who is reading all of these applications and evaluating the applications to not say no. Now, you know, we all have those stereotypes of folks working at the DMV. They work very hard. It's a very hard job. But they are looking for a reason to say no. And so I'm trying to remove all of those obstacles as much as I can. I think the kids call it malicious compliance. I remove as many of those obstacles as possible. And then, you know, we sign and seal the envelope, and I put a stamp on it, and I say to the person, you can take this to the mailbox, or I can take it to the mailbox right now, either way. Or you can take this check to the Oregon DMV right now. You know, what you get to choose. These are your ID documents, right? I want to be as transparent as possible. You know, I am not an organization. I'm just a private individual. I take everybody's, you know, identities and privacy very seriously. So I try to be very transparent about all of those steps.
And that brings me to my next question. Like, who's behind you on this? Who's supporting you? This whole thing is coming right out of your mind.
Right. It's just me right now. I do have a plan to eventually form a nonprofit that will focus exclusively on ID assistance. I know the city of Phoenix, Arizona, and the city of San Diego in California have similar nonprofits that are focusing only on ID assistance for folks experiencing houselessness or poverty. Because, you know, one of the systemic obstacles is we do have a lot of great organizations in this city, but they're all silos. Really? They're all niches. Rose Haven is for folks experiencing or fleeing domestic violence, surviving domestic violence. You know, the Veterans Administration is for veterans, right? So there's like NIA is for Native American and Indigenous folks. So, you know, there are all of these communities that offer aspects of this assistance. But when you're in crisis, you don't have time to check all of the boxes. And too often, you're excluded from services because you've already accessed it at one point. Or, you know, you've timed out from accessing the resource. Or you make just a little too much money. Or you're not quite desperate enough, right? There's always an excuse. Someone's job is to say no. So I'm trying to remove the no. I'm just trying to, no questions asked. I'm not verifying your citizenship. I'm just a private individual trying to help people out. I am a notary public. I do take the notary commission seriously. There are steps that I take to verify identity for the notary commission. But by and large, it's just me.
The other thing I wanted to say about that is, as we're talking about these, as we said, they're heritage organizations that have been doing some of this work for decades, Rose Haven too. You know, often, too often, the way they're funded, they're put in this position where they have to compete with each other for limited funds that will come from the county or the city or wherever. But for you, it's crowdfunded.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I just reach out to my friends, and my former colleagues on social media. And I say, hey, you know, this is what I'm doing. And in the last 18, 19 months that I've been doing this project, I've helped probably 85 people in 19 months. And I've spent, in round numbers, I've spent about $1,400, both of my own money and of money that's been donated for this cause. In the big scheme of things, that's not a lot of money. It's really not that hard. It's just paperwork. And it's just needing to say the right thing at the right time on the right form. And yet it is an insurmountable obstacle for so many folks. Yeah.
Which brings me to another question. How does your work on ID recovery mm-hmm. ripple out to other sectors of the city? What is the bigger picture of impact on this for the larger society?
Yeah. Well, the granular side of that is, you know, think of all of the things, assuming, dear listener, that you are a privileged person who's housed. Think of all of the things that we take for granted that you wouldn't be able to have without an ID, right? Think of your bank account. Think of employment. Think of your access to healthcare.
Health
think
insurance,
of,
yeah.
Think of your access to shelter, to housing. There are all of these things that are intrinsically linked with this piece of plastic. And then, you know, think of losing that piece of plastic and being challenged at the border, being challenged, being pulled over in a traffic stop. You know, there are all of these ways that you could get caught up in some really ridiculous circumstances. And at, when I was leading shelter programs, we would have people go through that on average 2-year continuum to getting into housing, and they would get to that final step where all they needed to do was sign the paperwork, sign the lease. They'd gotten a voucher, they'd gotten clean and sober, they'd gotten a sponsor, they'd gotten a job, they'd put together first and last in a security deposit in this economy. And then the property manager says, I need to see your ID. I need to verify that you're here legally. And you know, it's heartbreaking, but I've seen it happen where that's the one thing that they overlooked. And then that housing opportunity goes away and they start back at square one again after doing all that work. So, you know, multiply that by 85, roughly. And I'm proud to say that that's how many folks potentially have moved forward on that particular path.
Because I also wanted to ask, how many people in the Portland metro area potentially need services like these you are providing? Goes back to that point in time count. But yeah. How many people?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Well, you know, at this point, we're getting into speculation because the data is so fuzzy. But, you know, these new safe rest villages have an average capacity of about 100 to 100, at most 120 tiny homes, right? So 120 individuals at most. And there's projected to be, I don't know, at last count there was supposed to be 6, but I don't know how many are actually online. I think only 2, maybe 3 are online right now. So that's what? That's at most, that's 360 folks who have been swept into these safe rest villages. And by the way, you know, I don't know if this is official. I don't know if this is what Urban Alchemy says they're doing officially. But what I heard on the ground is that they're giving them 90 days to be housing ready in those safe rest villages. So imagine that your encampment has been swept, you've lost your tent, you've lost all your belongings, and you have 90 days in a tiny house village to get yourself together so that you could get into housing. And nobody's telling you where you're going to go after those 90 days. Nobody tells you what's going to happen next. You just have to figure that out. So potentially that's, if you take those 3 villages that are online right now, I think, so that's about 360 people. The social media post you saw, Urban Alchemy had found one of my business cards and they had asked me to go visit one of their villages. And I had no idea how many people they had there. So I got there and didn't know what to expect. And there was a line of 11 people waiting for me. And so I cleaned out my bank account that day the money that I had that had been donated for this thing. And I was happy to do it, but I was also a little bit angry because Urban Alchemy just got $60 million from the city to do this.
Boy, yo, 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 yo.
And then what they didn't think this far ahead. Like they didn't, they hired all the staff from California, but then they didn't think of what were they going to do with all the people that they were bringing into their village. I don't want to speak ill of nonprofits, of people doing, there's people doing good work everywhere. I'm not trying to do a gotcha moment on anybody. It's just, this is Portland, the city that works.
Paul, do you know of anyone who's organizing unhoused people to vote anywhere in Oregon? Because it is legal to vote if you don't have a residential address.
That's absolutely right. And by the way, registering to vote is one of the strategies that I suggest to a person when they're trying to replace their ID. Because all you need is the last 4 digits of your social security number. You write that on the postcard to the Secretary of State, to your county elections, and they will send you. You will need a mailing address. You'll need a residence address. So that's another thing that you have to figure out. But you will then receive a voter registration card, and that is accepted as a proof of ID at the DMV or at the Department of Vital Statistics in Oregon. So I, without pushing any kind of political agenda or endorsing any candidate or ballot measure, I tell people, if you can, register to vote. Because, again, this is a proof of ID, and this will help you get your birth certificate or your state ID. I don't know of anybody doing an official voter registration drive. I know that Street Roots has in the past. I serve on the board of Street Books as well. And Street Books encourages people to register to vote as well. But now is the time, right? Because, you know, we've got us, we're gearing up for all kinds of fun things in the new year in our fair city and in our fair country. Yeah. And now is the time to register to vote.
If you're listening right now, my name is Lisa Loving. I'm consistently looking for who's doing that. If you know someone that's doing that, please contact me on social media however. Okay. We're running out of show. So Paul, I want to come back and say, coming back to an Iliad.
Yeah.
What do you want to see come from this project and what's next?
Yeah. Just like KBOO, I'm trying to raise money. We're trying to pay ourselves. We're trying to pay for the rights. We're trying to get back to all of the prisons in Oregon that we visited in 2018 and 2019, and to the prisons we weren't able to get to in that first tour. So we're just trying to raise money, and, you know, my plan is to keep performing or rehearsing in Iliad at least once a year, or at least once a month, until we get that tour back on its feet, because it's really hard to learn all the lines.
I can imagine. And, last question, how can listeners support your ID program or an Iliad?
Yeah. You know, I'm not yet a nonprofit. I'm trying to be. So I don't have all the paperwork yet. Right now, the best way to get money to any of these projects is simply to my Venmo, which is at Paul, Paul-J-Susi, S-U-S-I. That's my Venmo. And, you know, go see live theater. Go buy a Street Roots. Go say hello to an unhoused neighbor. Like, be the community that we are yearning for right now. That is the biggest way to support any of this work.
Paul, I just want to thank you again for being here. Paul Susi, find out more about what they do online at paulsusi.wordpress.com. That's PAULSUSI. And then /PDX ID Assistance. More on the Iliad online at annafritz.com/an Iliad. Donate to KBOO right now during the end of year campaign, because this is really important information that I haven't seen in the daily paper. And I also don't want to be negative, but this is just really, it's right from the mouths of the people that are doing the work, and it's worthy of your investment. KBOO is the grassrootiest. KBOO is the place where real ideas start and grow. Your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of KBOO donors. Now's the perfect time to contribute because it's the end of the year campaign. Double your contribution. You can make it to support programming like this at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321, or mail a check to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You're listening to Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving on KBOO Portland. You can make a contribution. We already just talked about it. Special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making this all possible. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.fm. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Just bees and things and flowers. Just bees and things and flowers. Just bees and things and flowers. My life, my life, my life, my life in the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine. Folks getting down in the sunshine. Yeah, yeah.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO